But that to me is how my life has been affected by literature. I am able to feel things that I haven't felt before. I'm able to see the world and people's cultures and stories differently, especially now. Reading is especially important now when nobody's listening to each other, you know? At least read about other people's lives and backgrounds if you're not going to listen to them. You know, I think it helps me understand grief. It helps me understand love and joy and, you know, being lost. Anyway, I could just keep, go for hours. It's just, I find it a life raft.
Welcome to Chasing Leviathan. I'm your host, PJ Weary, and I'm here today with Tetiana Denford. She's the author of the novel Motherland, and also of her newest book, Conversations with Grief, a collection of prose and poetry designed to help a reader reframe how they deal with grief. And the question we're going to be covering today is, how can fiction and poetry help us answer life's biggest questions? But before we delve too deep into that, I'd love to just start by asking you saying thank you for joining us, Tetiana. And how did you fall in love with literature? How did that passion start?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. This is wonderful. And such a great topic to discuss, which I could probably discuss for hours. How did I fall into it?
How did you fall in love with literature?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of writers will say this, but I've been writing as long as I can remember. I think since I was about 10, I started writing seriously, and it was because of a teacher. His name was Mr. Allen. I'll never forget. He had the most amazing English class. I had been writing poetry like since 10, and I'd been kind of entering local competitions and being published in the local newspaper, which is fine. And then Mr. Allen got me to understand the magic of writing and how amazing it is to get something out of your head onto the page. Something that doesn't exist, you can make exist. And I think teachers anyway are superhuman. They are heroes. They are under-celebrated and underpaid. And I think teachers, apart from parents and grandparents, are the most influential human beings on a child's life. And he just got me to love reading, to love, you know, stories like To Kill a Mockingbird and Shakespeare's sonnets and, you know, all the things that were taught so kind of repeatedly as we were growing up. But I think it's up to a teacher to kind of really bring it to life, as they do with any subject. Mm. But in particular, for me, that was kind of the moment. So,
well, you had a great teacher, so that's why you did fall in love with it, right?
Yeah. And he was a mentor. He was a bit of a father figure. I mean, I'm close with my parents, but he was just this guy that, I don't know how he did it, but he was just kind of magical the way he delivered literature to me anyway. And I just knew I wanted to kind of keep it in the background of, you know, my life. I never kind of set out to have a career one day in it, but I definitely knew that it was something that was just going to be quite, you know, something that I would always be doing. Yeah.
Is that, so how did that transition happen where you're like, oh, I want to make a career out of this?
I went to, again, this is going to be another teacher figure in my life, but I went to Middlebury College, and it was wonderful. And I kind of took a lot of classes on, you know, biblical literature, philosophy, religion, and also writing. And I didn't know what I wanted to major in. I knew I wanted to do something with languages as well, because I speak different languages and that's really fun. But I didn't know what exactly I wanted to do within literature. And I had two amazing mentors, one who has passed on, sadly. His name is Robert Pack. He is a very celebrated poet. He was very influential in getting me to understand how complicated and difficult writing poetry actually is. It's not just some, you know, you don't just put a handful of words together and publish it and go, I'm a poet now. You know, it's as difficult in a lot of ways as writing a novel, but just in a different way. The other person,
I mean, it doesn't stop people from doing that. But I appreciate what you're saying. Yes. Sorry, go ahead.
Check out the greeting card section in any Target. the other person is luckily still alive, and he's wonderful. And his name is Jay Perini. He wrote a book called The Station Agent, got turned into a movie. He is very, very talented and he was very specific in answering my questions about whether this could be something that I could do for a living. He never sugarcoated anything. And I thought, you know, these guys have made a career out of it, not just because they want to be celebrated writers and publish lots of books and make lots of money, but because they were also teaching it in a university, which I think is incredibly difficult, probably. I mean, you know, I don't think I could do that. And I found them very impressive and inspirational. And I just thought, I just wonder if I could get to that point. And again, it didn't solidify my plan to start writing novels and poetry and, you know, but all of these dots kind of connected, because it reminded me that, you know, no matter what, I could always be a writer. I could always write on the side, publish here and there. I could be a freelance writer, which I was when I moved to New York in my 20s. So it was just always this parallel life that was happening whilst I was trying to figure out who I was and what I wanted. It was always there. I was always reading. I was always writing. So I didn't really connect the dots until much later in my life. But they were very influential, and I'm really grateful for them, you know.
And that's, yeah, they're, as a former teacher, I appreciate your words. Especially, I mean, I don't think anyone will really disagree with you about underpaid. But it's so true. There is no replacement for people who speak into your life like that.
Yeah.
Who are able to ignite passion for something. And I think you're right. Parents, that's a big part of it. And I think grandparents, but teachers, you get to, and it's very similar to if someone gets connected through the trades, right?
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whatever that is, having true mentorship is just such a blessing, and there's no replacement for it. So I absolutely 100% agree with you. So as we get started on this, how can fiction and poetry help us answer life's biggest questions? So now that you've delved into it, you are writing yourself. Maybe you could give us some examples of life-changing moments for you that you've experienced through, and I'll say literature instead of saying fiction and poetry every time, though I understand that's kind of a, not necessarily a one for one, but what are some of the most life-changing moments that you have experienced through literature?
I think the way I can kind of start to try and describe it is, like, you know, you remember every human being remembers moments by certain smells or certain meals that they had, music that they heard for the first time, gigs that they were at. And I think for me, and probably for a lot of people, books are the same thing. And I remember when I first read Middlemarch in high school, I thought it was quite an astounding piece of work. And I thought, how can somebody, it was my first kind of thought was, how can somebody write like this. And also Middlemarch is a huge book.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And the storyline, the plot is so complicated and there are so many characters. I remember feeling like that was quite profoundly inspiring to me to understand, like, I thought to myself, maybe one day I could kind of do that. I remember when I first read My Ishmael. That's a very niche book by Daniel Quinn. I will never forget when it kind of changed my perspective on the world. My Ishmael is basically I won't give any spoilers, but the plot is about a man who answers an ad in a newspaper. And the ad is saying, like, I want somebody who wants to understand, like, the world and who wants to kind of hear a message, basically. And he goes to this office block, and there's an empty office, and there's a giant gorilla in the office. And the gorilla speaks to him and explains about how the world works. It is such a mind-blowing piece of fiction that it basically says how there are some people who are takers and some people who are givers. And then there are some civilizations who, like it. I can't, it's so wonderfully articulate, but also speaks in metaphor. And I read it going, my brain just kind of exploded when I first read that. And it made me look at the world in a different way. So there are these kind of moments where I was studying in Oxford and I was doing medieval poetry kind of analysis. And I love the subtext and the hidden meanings behind so many works of poetry. I love how you can compare death to a thing with feathers, you know, or you can, you know, I feel like my life has happened in a collection of these moments that are centered around literature. It's a really wild feeling because I'm the same with food. Certain things that I've eaten for the first time, or, you know, smells remind me of people. I'm just like that with books. You know, I remember reading, I'll never forget reading the book Stoner, which is an amazing book. If you've never read it, oh my God.
No, I'm not familiar.
I recommend it to everybody. It is an exquisite, almost perfect novel, I think, in my opinion. And I remember finishing that book, and I remember where I was. I was in the UK. We were in our house in this small little village, and it was at night. I think it was at 10 p.m. Kids were asleep. My husband and I were in the kitchen, and I was sat on the kitchen counter finishing this last page, and I put the book down, and I sobbed for 15 minutes straight, I swear. I was just bereft. That to me is an act of some kind of supernatural ability. It's magic. It is, I don't know. And my goal is to do that as a writer, but that to me is how my life has been affected by literature. I am able to feel things that I haven't felt before. I'm able to see the world and people's cultures and stories differently, especially now. Reading is especially important now when nobody's listening to each other, you know? At least read about other people's lives and backgrounds if you're not going to listen to them. You know, I think it helps me understand grief. It helps me understand love and joy and, you know, being lost. Anyway, I could just go for hours. It's just, I find it a life raft to me and my life.
Oh, I was actually going to ask you a different question, but can you explain a little bit more about the life raft metaphor?
I reach for books and writing in particular when I feel lost, when I feel like I don't have anyone to express myself to, which isn't very often. I'm very lucky. I have wonderful friends and an incredible husband and family and stuff. So, but when I really can't articulate how I feel, I reach for other people's lives, like biographies. Or I write because sometimes I don't understand how to make sense of what is rolling around in my brain. To me, books and writing are a key that opens a door into a place where I feel like I can have some peace if I need it. And that to me is what I mean by life raft. I think it allows me to escape, but not in a put my head in the sand in a way. It allows me to step away from the painting, I guess,
and gain perspective.
Absolutely. And see it in a better way.
To see better. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are crucial and important things. A lot of what you're mentioning, I don't know if you're familiar with Charles Taylor.
No.
He's a philosopher. I'm currently working through his book, The Language Animal. Oh. And one of the things he mentioned is that there are domains of language. He calls them the excessive, A-C-C-E-S-S-I-V-E, and the existential. And I could go on for hours about that. I mean, and I'm just through the first chapter. It's a heavier work of philosophy. It's not like a light read. So obviously, like, there's a lot to talk about, right? But he said one of the great things about literature and just language in general, and he's arguing for a specific philosophy of language, is that by creating new words, we can either explain something that we already know but can't articulate, or we can literally, and that would be the excessive, to access something, or the existential, literally to create a new way of being. And for him, he puts that in terms of and he includes body language as part of language, which I think, you know, not to get too into the weeds on that, but obviously we understand that there are certain gestures you can do with your hand that would obviously count as language.
Completely. Yeah.
Yes. I think anyone who's driven understands that. Yeah. And so for him, that's the example he uses is there's an entire way of being for instance, the example is a biker, like a certain machismo, probably saying that wrong, but the way they carry themselves and the words that they use, and those aren't entirely explainable, but they are characterizable.
That's
where literature I think that's what you're talking about here, is that literature, you feel maybe trapped in some scenario and you need to gain either access to where you know you need to go, or you need to create a new way. And just, it really seems to me, am I tracking with you?
Yes, absolutely. And do you know what? I think one of the masters of being able to do that is E.E. Cummings. And I know, like, he is overshared and over, like, his quotes are so overdone. It's like, it's almost people use him like a live, laugh, love kind of thing. But I think what's really, it's terrible. Poor guy.
My mom loves the live, laugh, love type of stuff. And I just like, oh man, it's, we live in a multi-generational house. And so there's been some very careful, like, she's like, well, you could use this. And we're like, we'll think about it, you know?
Yeah. Interesting. I'll write it down. No, but I think E. Cummings is just so adept at creating new worlds and new words and ways to, he paints things with his language that are like something out of A Wrinkle in Time. You know, it's that kind of just magical, he makes you feel, and he makes you feel like sometimes joyous and sometimes like dirty, in a sense, like you've been rolling around in the weeds, or like he's
very
just
sensual, not necessarily in a sexual way, just sensual of the senses, right?
Yeah. And I remember he described in one of his poems, I remember when I first read this, again, this is like how my life is connected with dots in a way. I remember I was a teenager when I first read that line, spring is when things are something, I'm paraphrasing here, things are mud luscious and puddle wonderful. I'm like, come on, who, How does he do that? You can just, you can almost feel it in your teeth when you even say that.
Yeah,
when
you
say that line, it's just gorgeous. So so that I agree. Yeah.
You know, for me, and I, so when you talk about crying and, I remember I first time I read, the only time I've read, I want to read it again, but A Farewell to Arms by Ernest Hemingway.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Oh, and I finished that last page and then I found out, I don't know if you're familiar with the, Paris Review interviews.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got the box set and it, and Hemingway's in there. And there, it's now, I got really lucky. I bought it and I was like, in grad school, I was like, I don't really have the money for this. But it was $45 and now it's out of print and it's like $180, $240. And I'm like, I'm so glad I bought this.
Yeah.
But he spent, he rewrote that last page 39 times.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Because and he was famously bad tempered because he believed it was bad luck to write in interviews or to talk about writing in interviews. Yeah. So like he's very tongue in cheek the whole time and very passive aggressive. But that was one of the real sticking points. And I was like, well, the effort showed because I just cried at the end. And it was that same feeling of like, how can words do this to me?
Yeah.
I've only gotten 200 pages into it, but because it's really long and part of it is the magic of what he does. I have to be in the right space to read Proust.
Oh, right. Yeah, of course.
I haven't read a lot of Cummings, but and the one that always sticks out to me, it's like in the on the second page, because I was trying to describe to other people, I'm trying to get them to read Proust and like they're like, so it's a novel that's 3,000 words. And I'm like, and it's really hard to read because it's just so involving.
That doesn't
and
they're like,
but he's just talking about when he's like going into the village and he's like, it was that time of night when an invalid wakes up from his sleep. And a light shows under the door and he gets really excited because he thinks that the dawn is coming and the servant's coming to help him. And then the light passes and he realizes it was someone with a candle going by and he is going to have to lie there awake all night without any help.
Oh God.
And I was like, but it had nothing to do with the story. It was literally just a description of that time of night. And I felt that like, even if just having the flu, I've not been an invalid, but like that moment when you wake up in the middle of the night and you're like, no, I just want to sleep more. Cause this is just going to be painful and I can't ask anyone.
Yeah.
And it, but it reminds me, I mean, it's different from Cummings in that obviously it's a little, like Proust is a little wordier.
Yeah.
But that feeling of just like, you just feel it. So it's so clear if you've ever experienced that.
Completely.
And, it's really a fascinating and awesome thing. One of the questions, I wanted to bring up and you kind of touched on this is, does your dual citizenship in Britain and America give you a unique literary perspective?
Oh, that's a great question. For me personally, it was I started writing quite seriously when I was still in the UK. So the first thing that I noticed was that I, even though my voice is the same, I look back and I realize that a lot of stuff I had to change because of spelling.
I was just about to say all the U's. Yeah.
So originally my novel was written to be published in the UK, but then we decided to move back to New York. So of course, kind of, you know, that was a very interesting, thing to have to deal with. But, I think it's interesting because, yes and no, I think literature is so universal that, there wasn't necessarily a difference, but I think within the industry, I felt like it was smaller and cozier and harder to break through.
Interesting.
However, having said that, when I did submit, I had a lot of UK agents interested with my novel. So... shh. There's literally nobody there. There's nobody there. Louis, shush. So the interest was very UK based. And what's interesting is that UK agents, like the UK industry, is actually very open armed when it comes to the UK industry is very open with just they're nice. I don't think I have the same feeling necessarily, even though the industry in the US is very big. Which is great in a lot of ways. You can make so many more kind of contacts in a lot of ways, and you can find more smaller publishing houses. But the UK just felt like I was part of a group, and it was a really nice feeling. The letdowns were much nicer. The rejections were much nicer, and I'm still in contact with so many people in that industry, and I hope that one day I'll be able to be, I want to try getting published traditionally one day, maybe. And hopefully maybe in the UK, because I just think it's a very different feeling. It's maybe, even though it's still business minded, it's a little bit more human as well.
Yeah.
It feels like.
Yeah. Yeah, bigger pool, a little more cutthroat in America.
I mean,
I could see that.
Yeah.
Yes, you can break through more, but I assume that there's more competition too.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense to me.
And the US market may be looking for slightly different things. I think the US market is looking for things that are very marketable, and they can sell. Not that the UK isn't, you know, so I'm not kind of pitting one against the other. I think both of them obviously have their pluses and minuses, but I just like the people I know, maybe I'm a bit biased, but the people kind of I've been lucky enough to chat to and trade emails with and, you know, be connected to on my social media platforms. A lot of them are UK based, and it's just, it feels like a nice little group.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Thank you. Talk to me a little bit about conversations with grief. Mm-hmm. When you talk about, I was really struck by the phrase, you talk about reframing for the reader.
Yeah.
If I read that correctly. How do you reframe grief through poetry and prose?
I wanted grief in particular, and then this kind of series of books that I'm writing that are called conversation books. I wanted to have people talk about grief, not in always a morbid way. I wanted people to see grief as this slightly unwanted friend that shows up on your doorstep and you don't know what to do with them. You have no choice. You kind of have to invite them in. And some days you're going to find them really annoying, and they're going to make you angry, and they're going to make you cry. And then some days you're just grateful that they're there because they remind you of certain things that you've lost and that you miss. And, you know, I think it helps you get a different perspective about something that we live with. Human beings live with it every single day, whether, you know, and grief comes in different forms. We live with it when we get our heart broken for the first time, when we love someone, when we're younger. We deal with it when we're a kid and our pet dies. We, you know, when a grandparent dies when we're younger, when if a father or a mother or any kind of guardian leaves and your life changes. You deal with that as a kid if your parents get divorced. You know, so I wanted to talk about it because it is a constant, and I think people push away from it. And I think people are scared to talk about it because they feel like if they talk about it, it'll kind of open up something awful inside them. And okay, it might trigger certain things, but I think shoving it away is just really impractical and probably sometimes dangerous and bad for our mental health. So.
Yeah, I people are afraid to be vulnerable.
Yeah, completely.
And, you know, it's really interesting in terms of counseling and not that I'm a psychiatrist by any stretch of the imagination, but that whole idea of people have a hard time seeing the end of the story.
Yeah.
So they're afraid to talk about their grief because they see the pain that that will cause talking about it, but they don't see when they're done talking about it, where they'll be.
Yeah. That's a wonderful, that's a wonderful way to put it.
Yeah. And that's, it definitely makes me want to pick it up. Why grief in particular? Is that something that you were going through at that time? I mean, if you don't feel comfortable answering, that's fine too.
No. I'm an open book. I mean, pardon the pun.
I'm a dad. That's bad puns are not only on the table, they're encouraged.
I mean, when I didn't realize that I would start writing it until, so my first book, Motherland, was written about a family secret that was uncovered that my grandmother had kept her whole life. And when that came out, I'm an only child. So I was the only person that could write it in my family. And I think it was an important thing that I had to do and I had to take on. Because I'm writing it for myself, for my children, for my children's children. It's, you know, and it was, anyway, it's loosely based on my grandmother's life. And a month after I published it, she died. And she was a very formidable figure in my life. She was very complicated. We had a complicated relationship. But towards the end of her life, we kind of got back to where we were when I was six, and she was kind of helping raise me when my parents were commuting and stuff. And when she died, I felt completely untethered. You know, I felt like I was kind of drifting. I felt a bit lost. I felt like my purpose had gone. And the only way I could deal with it, I tried gardening because she really liked gardening. I thought, oh, okay. And it took me like a couple of days before I realized I kill everything green. So I couldn't do it. So that wasn't therapeutic for me. Going for running or working out wasn't kind of the thing. And where I really found myself and found myself healing was when I took my dog for a walk, for hikes in the woods every morning. And in that process, I would talk to myself sometimes out loud. And I thought, you know, I'm kind of talking to myself, but I'm also talking to my own grief. I'm talking to her, wherever she is. I would ask her questions. I would ask myself questions. But then I also thought, how many people are also dealing with this, especially in the last year that we've had with COVID and stuff? Like, I wonder how many people are really not knowing how to deal with grief and loss and their sadness and their frustration. And sometimes grief makes you laugh out loud and act really nuts, and you can't explain it, you know? And so I started taking notes in my phone, and suddenly these pieces started really kind of making sense of it for me. And I thought, well, okay, why don't I just kind of collect them all, see where it leads me? I had literally had no plan. And then suddenly I had a 100-page book that was kind of waiting to be edited. So I thought, okay, that's interesting. And I didn't really struggle for a title. And I was like, well, maybe, you know, it took me much longer to find the title for my novel. Whereas this, I was like, it's basically just conversation. Like, I'm making conversation with these invisible things and with strangers on the internet when I connected to them with grief and about grief. So that's where I ended up. And it was because I was really living through it and I had no choice. And it was present all the time. It was walking next to me. It was at night in the grandfather clock that never chimed, suddenly started chiming at random moments. I'm like, okay, well, hi, you know, so all these strange things were happening and I was writing it down and I could not stop writing. And it's been the most enjoyable thing in a lot of ways to write. And yes, it was sometimes I would cry when I would write, but it was, I was capturing these moments in this immediacy. And I mean, that's what poetry is. It's capturing a moment and trying to connect to somebody else in that moment. So it really helped me heal. So yeah, I was really kind of heavy into my grief when I started writing it.
Thank you. And I appreciate your vulnerability in sharing that. And, it's just, it's a real, really precious thing to be able to work through something like that. And it's really interesting because I've definitely seen people who hold on to those things and refuse to express those things. And it's very dangerous. And so how do you see the book reframing it for other people?
I think...
Well, if you can explain the term reframe.
Yeah.
Because I think I know what you mean, but I would love to hear it articulated or explained.
I think when a lot of people deal with kind of loss, they look for self-help books, which is great. But there is a certain kind of book that's always out there. And I wanted to create something where somebody can open up this book and see themselves in these moments, but not specifically see death and dying and destruction and sadness. I wanted them to also see the shades of joy that grief can bring. I also wanted them to see how children approach grief and how they describe it. There is a poem that I have in there called What My 11-Year-Old Said to Me That Day When I Was Crying. And it's about how a child can say, can look at love and loss as a vampire, you know, showing up on a doorstep waiting to be fed. You know, I wanted people to reframe grief in their mind with other images and other colors and not just gray and dark and miserable, because I think that's what we have as humans, the both fortunately and unfortunately, the ability to experience life in so many different ways, not just one cookie cutter way. And I think so many books describe grief in very limited terms. And I think I could keep writing this book, honestly, like for 100 more pages. I have so much more material that exists in my head that just comes up off of, you know, looking at something green and going like, that is not the opposite of grief. We appreciate this green because there is dying, you know, it's like, you know, love and grief are married, you know, they are not opposites. They work together. So yeah, that's why I mean,
you can't have grief without love. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, and you touched on this a little bit. How would you say, what does literature provide that self-help or philosophy or theology doesn't? In regards to life's big questions.
I don't know if it provides... I think they work in tandem. I think you can find philosophy within literature, but not in an obvious way. So... I think philosophy books are great. I think, you know, they are very helpful in trying to expand your mind and your perspective. And I think it's sometimes crucial for people to read something very specific by a specific doctor of philosophy because they need a specific thing. But I think literature might have less boundaries, I'd have to say, especially with poetry. I think because of the lack of boundaries and because there's more creativity within that, I think it's maybe less prescriptive, but I think it still works in the same way. I just think poetry or kind of literature in general helps people that don't necessarily have the craving to reach for a specific work of someone's because they frame things in a specific way or, you know, they present things in a certain way. I think, you know, poetry and literature can kind of let you have wings and let you figure out what you need you know, without being specific about it.
They give you a chance to be more creative.
Yes. Well, and they give the reader a chance, or somebody who's really struggling with something, they give somebody a chance to read something that will make them feel better without saying, here's how your brain should think, or here's what you need to eat to feel better. Here's, do you know what I mean? Some people need that sometimes, but then some people are like, I don't know what I need. I just want to kind of sink my teeth into a reading something that will make me go, oh, for no explainable reason, you know?
Yeah. You've mentioned some of your own favorite books that have done that. You know, you mentioned Stoner, in particular, you know, you gave it your wholehearted recommendation.
Oh, so good.
I didn't catch the author.
Oh my God. I should know better. Hang on. Oh my goodness. Oh, I should know
one
this.
Second.
Is it, hang on. Stoner is by
John Williams?
Is it John Williams?
Was it written
yes.
in 1965?
Yes, yeah,
John
it
Williams.
Is John Williams. I apologize. Yeah.
No. I forgot my best friend's name in seventh grade.
Oh, no.
Like I literally walked up to my mom and I walked into the kitchen. I was like, who's that redheaded kid that I always hang out with? And she like gave like some names of kids I'd like met once or twice. I was like, no, the one who like comes and stays the night about like once a month. She's like, you mean Nick? And I'm like, yes.
Oh,
she's like, what? She's like, how did you not know his name? I'm like,
listen,
my brain, it just lost it.
We're all getting older. Just blame it on old age. The other,
I mean, I'd love to. I was like 12 years old. I don't know what happened there.
We're too much sugar. I don't know.
It's something else.
No, the other book I hugely recommend, which is was hugely inspiring to me writing my first novel, was Revolutionary Road.
Hmm.
That was made into a movie, which is actually exquisitely done. But the book is it is a searing portrait of a marriage falling apart in suburbia, but it's exquisitely written. It is, oh my God, it is just gorgeous.
Not the Adam Driver movie, right?
No, that is the marriage story. Revolutionary Road, they made with Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio, which sounds too obvious. You're like, oh God, are you kidding? But it is truly spectacular. But I'd say read the book first. The book really...
Always, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's by Richard Yates?
Yes. The book really affected me. Yeah.
Yeah. Who are some of your favorite authors and books? You know, obviously those two. Do you have some other ones that help you push boundaries, that help you grow? And is there a particular, like when you talk about how awesome Revolutionary Road is, is there a particular kind of boundary that pushes? Is there a particular life raft that presents?
It allowed me to see what sacrifices we make at what cost as humans in relationships. So it wasn't necessarily a life raft. It was a peek into a world that I wouldn't really have thought about. It was like being dropped into a family for a little while, and especially a couple in their relationship, and how we as human beings really sacrifice our dreams in order to make certain things work. But we lose ourselves in those sacrifices sometimes. And it's really upsetting to read a book like that. But at the same time, it was kind of wonderful, perversely. I'm like, God, it really is true. Like, what do we give up? You know, what do we give up? We have one life. What do we give up? And can we live with that? Can we live with that, what we're giving up? You know? I thought it was a really just amazing premise.
And even kind of tagging along with that, I think there's a lot of use in a story that helps us to see what happens when things fall apart. without us having to experience it, so that we have some idea without experiencing it ourselves. Like, and if we do choose to go down that road, we our eyes are a little more open.
And I like that. And it's these two books in particular, Stoner and Revolutionary Road. I really enjoy the fact that they don't have tidy Hollywood endings. The authors present reality in a really brutal way. And I find that amazing. It's like, you know, the movie Manchester by the Sea.
I am familiar with it. I've not seen it. That's Casey Affleck, right? Yeah.
That's a movie, obviously. So I know we're talking about books, but that movie is also, is heartbreaking, but it doesn't tie everything together nicely. It just leaves things open-ended. And I quite enjoy books like that. I don't mind nice endings, but when it's I don't want it to be obvious. I want it to make sense with the plot. It's like one of my favorite authors, her name is Glendi Vandera, and she wrote two books. One is called, The Forest Through the Trees. I think, hang on. Yeah, I think it's called bless her. And she and I are connected on social media, so I should
know. Light Through the Leaves.
Okay, well, that's her second one, The Light Through the Leaves. The first one.
Her website doesn't show her books. That's funny.
oh no.
Where the Forest Meets the Stars.
Where the Forest Meets the Stars. Those two books are beautiful. But again, it's a study of what humans go through and what we sacrifice and what we have to live with and how heartbreaking life can be and how tricky it is. I think I just like studies of humanity, I think, within plots. I think it's really wonderful. And I think I'm like that in real life anyway. I'm just curious about people and their stories, like genuinely. I want to go through life kind of devouring the world and like learning about people. And, you know, her books are just, oh my God, you would love them. I devoured them in like 3 days, honestly. They're just wonderful. Yeah.
So you're talking here, and I mean, it makes sense, right? Like the more difficult books, the more brutally realistic books. I think people understand how those connect to great questions in life. Do you believe that tidy ending books, by that, or maybe even just tidy books in general? So for instance, think like the detective genre, the mystery genre, you know, where it's like, oh, it's a whodunit and we're going to, you know, have the scene at the end. Do you think those provide any help with the big questions of life? What value do those kind of books have? You know, romance novels, the formula ones.
I think my own personal opinion with genres like that, I think they are a definite tool to help people escape. I think they are great entertainment. There's definitely skill involved in writing books like that. I couldn't write books like that. I've tried. I'm terrible. I just can't. And I think authors like that are really true to what they can do. I mean, like the Grisham and the, you know, all of those are like, to me, it's like sitting down and watching an old favorite movie. You know, to me, I love a gangster film. So that to me is like a comfort movie, which is really funny. You know, so if I feel
it's true though, right? Yeah.
I know. If I feel like a duvet day, I want to watch Goodfellas, you know? So books like that, I think, you know, provide.
I have never heard duvet day, but I'm definitely going to steal that. Sorry. Go ahead.
I don't get enough of those, actually. I don't allow myself to relax. But if I do, I reach for movies like that. And I think people reach for books like that, the crime genre, the thriller genre, like Gone Girl. I loved Gone Girl because it was fun to read. I completely escaped. I didn't have to think in a lot of ways. I just loved how it was crafted. I think Gillian Flynn is fantastically talented, you know. So I think books like that are just, they are great. They serve a very specific purpose and in a great way. I think people who don't want to have to think about the world or humanity or their relationship, or they have to deal with loss and stuff. Sometimes people just need a fun read to just escape, you know, and I think it's important.
Appreciate that. That's it's a really a fascinating thing how often we do need those kinds of escapes.
Yeah. And it's not being lazy reading books like that. You need that. If you just had, if the world was only publishing self-help and poetry books that are quite heavy and like historical novels, oh my God, like we would just like, we would go a little bit nuts. You know,
if every book was Middlemarch. Yeah.
Oh God,
or Anna Karenina. Yeah.
It's just too much. We'd all like play music it's all in minor keys, and we'd be like staring into the middle distance, questioning our life choices. I mean,
oh man. Yeah. Could you imagine if everybody was Dostoevsky? It'd just be the worst.
Well.
Oh man. Thank you so much for your time today. As we wrap up here, is there something that you, first, is there something that you want to plug? Other than your two books, I mean, obviously you have Motherland and you have Conversations with Grief. You have Conversations, I don't know the titles, but you're doing similar conversation books with motherhood and love. And so if there's anything else you want to plug, but also, is there a way that you could sum up kind of that, an answer to that question? How can fiction and poetry help us answer life's biggest questions?
So, firstly, this has been so much fun. I don't get a chance to talk to people other than my children. So this is, so beyond all the book chat and the philosophy stuff, this is actually just really fun. So thank you.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. I do want to plug. So yes. So Motherland is out on Amazon. It's historical fiction, loosely based on true events. My current book, Conversation with Grief, is everywhere on Amazon. It's available in paperback and hardcover. I'm trying to figure out if I can record the audio version for both this and Motherland. I'll get to that at some point. I have no idea how. So my next...
With all your free time as a mother,
I know,
yes.
Right? Oh, God. So I have three books, maybe four, in this conversation book series. My next one coming out after the Conversation with Grief one is Conversation with Motherhood. I'm really proud of that one. That's coming out at the end of the summer. And my third one, Conversation with Love, that's coming out hopefully end of November. And I might actually do a fourth one, Conversation with Aging. And self. So I don't know how like that will manifest, but hopefully next year at some point. I do have a YouTube show called The Craft and Business of Books, where my partner Marissa and I, we interview people in the publishing world and also the writing world. So we have interviews with authors, editors, marketing, writers, publicists. So basically, it's basically just trying to demystify the book world and just trying to get people to understand that these are human beings also behind these doors, and, you know, just to get a little bit of their perspective. So that's really fun. Next year, I'm hoping that I'm going to get together some self-publishing courses. It's basically kind of an offshoot of the Craft and Business of Books, but more towards self-publishing. And I think I get a lot of questions about self-publishing. And now that I have perspective on both like traditional publishing and self-publishing, I'd like to really help people kind of understand how it works and how to present yourself, how to write submission letters, and, you know, how to make your website look like you could sit along with, you know, traditionally published authors. So, yeah, so that's what I'm working on. And as far as the question, I'd say that I think literature is an answer for people who don't even know what the question is that they have in their mind. I think it's It's really hard to sum up, but I think that we have to allow ourselves to reach for literature and not be scared of not immediately finding answers. I think we live in a world that everything is so often instantaneous and instant gratification, and we want answers yesterday. And I think that's ultimately not really how the world works, and we've been conditioned to expect that, when I think literature is a slow burn. We just have to reach for it and be patient with it and let it kind of sink in and plant seeds, because at some point things start to make sense. But it reminds you how to be patient. It reminds you how to allow for creativity and for space to exist in your brain, not just quick answers.
And it allows us to adapt to those individual circumstances through that emphasis on creativity. Thank you. That's a wonderful summation of what we've been talking about here today.
Thank you.
Tatiana, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much. And thank you for coming on. It's been it's so much fun having these kind of discussions. Literature is kind of the main love of my life. So other than behind my wife, Becky Sue. But it's just been a real joy to talk to you today. So thank you.
Thank you, PJ, for having me.